On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello! Welcome to the methodologically problematic edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. It's been a busy week this week, so we have lots to talk about. I am Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm here with Anna Szymanski, who's
Hello.
Going to drop some knowledge about Italian bank bailouts.
Yep.
This is why we have her around these parts. But I am here with Slate's very own Jordan Weissman, who's also going to drop some knowledge about Seattle minimum wages.
Yep.
I am...
That was the one guy redo that.
He's going to squeak.
I don't know.
Jordan is in a very squeaky mood this week.
We should just keep going.
We should just keep going.
Hey, everyone. It's me. I don't know why I just squeaked at you. This is what usually ends up on the cutting room floor. Good morning, everyone.
But yeah, so let's...
Blame the bed bugs. Yeah, keep going.
So Jordan, yeah, if we can get Jordan past his, like, cracking himself up, we will talk about the minimum wage in Seattle. It went up, and... that may or may not have had, what's the word, disemployment effects. We will come to that. But first, we have to mention the $2.4 billion fine, which was recently imposed by Margarita Vestager, the European Competition Commissioner, on Google, which is a great story. And I've been thinking about this one quite a bit because you can take it... basically, you can read her complaint against Google and you're like, this makes perfect sense. They're totally being anti-competitive and they should get fined and there's this remedy. And then you read Google's response and you're like, no, Google's totally right. And I think I'm coming down on the side of Google here. I'm not sure. But let's first explain what she's upset about. And what she's upset about is comparison shopping.
Yep.
And this may or may not be a subset of search. We'll get to that. But basically, when you type in, and the example people are using, I'm not quite sure why, is Puma shoes. This seems to be the standard example
on the internet. I'm guessing that Puma still has some brand presence in
Europe. Well, they're German, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, you type Puma shoes into Google, and then there'll be some ads at the top of the search results for people selling Puma shoes. There'll be non-ad results from Puma itself and other people selling Puma shoes. And then along the top of the page, you will see a bunch of photographs of Puma shoes being sold by various merchants online and with prices attached to them. And this is basically something called Google Shopping. It's a comparison shopping service, which they just embed in the search results. You can go there separately. It has its own website at shopping.google.com, mm-hmm. But almost no one does. The main way that people use Google Shopping is just because it turns up in the search results. And so if you want to click on one of their search results, they're very clearly labeled as being an ad, and you can click on that shoe and buy it and go straight to the website. Now, what the Europeans are saying is other websites perform the same function, that you can go to other comparison shopping websites and look at different shoes being sold by different people and work out which one's cheapest or best or whatever. And they are saying that Google is anti-competitively promoting its own comparison shopping service above the others, which have now been relegated to like page 5 of the search results where no one will ever see them.
Yeah, which it is. Like, it is promoting its shopping service above the others. I mean, it is right there at the top of the bar and the others have disappeared into the other of page five.
Right, but it's not as though you can only shop through Google. I mean, you're immediately going to see Amazon. You're immediately going to see Puma. You're immediately going to see many other
sites. The question is whether or not this is predatory, right? It's like, yeah, that they are doing this. I don't think anyone is, very few people would question whether or not they are leveraging their power in search to promote their own shopping service. The question is this an antitrust violation?
And certainly if you are a price comparison competitor to Google, it's easy to see how you might feel that way.
Yes.
right.
You know, once upon a time, before Google Shopping really took off, you would have done better on your SEO. You might have been more likely to make it onto the front page. And then all of that traffic died away. And now how are people going to even find you?
But I guess I would also ask, did that traffic also die because consumer habits have changed in terms of how we shop? We don't use comparison shopping tools
well,
as often.
Well, we do. And this is the interest. This is one of the points that Google makes, is that it is actually quite small as a comparison shopping service. If you compare it to the biggest comparison shopping service of all, which is Amazon.
Right. Yeah.
And Amazon is, you know, has its own issues about like promoting its own wares as opposed to other people using its platform, which Julia Angwin and others have written about at length. But Amazon is a pretty good comparison shopping service. And what Google is saying is that we are competing with Amazon. We're not competing with other services which are going to be down in the search results.
Yeah, but the antitrust question here isn't whether or not Google is a comparison shopping monopolist. It's whether they essentially have monopoly on search and then are using that to unfairly undercut their competitors.
And so this is the real crux of the matter, is what the European Union is alleging is that they are abusing their search monopoly in order to give an artificial advantage to their comparison shopping business, much as, to use the obvious precedent here, Microsoft abused its operating system monopoly to give itself an artificial advantage in browsers.
Yes.
And back then, people kind of agreed and eventually came to the conclusion that the browser was a separate business from the operating system. And so you shouldn't be able to use one to give yourself an artificial advantage in the other. I kind of agree with that, although, you know, I could be persuaded either way, especially nowadays with things like Chrome, where the browser basically is the operating system. I feel like distinction is becoming blurrier. But in this particular case, I really do believe that comparison shopping is part and parcel of what people want from search, that they're not really two different things. When you're comparison shopping, by definition, you're searching for something.
Right. But I think we've already said that essentially the biggest comparison shopping tool is Amazon.
And people search on Amazon as
well.
But
if you Google something, you will get Amazon results on the first page. So the idea that this is anti-competitive, it's anti-competitive against very tiny European comparison shopping tools, but not against Google's biggest competitor.
I mean, it's also anti-competitive against Google's biggest competitor because with the Amazon links, you need to click on the link and go to Amazon.
Yeah. Right.
With the Google links, you get pretty photographs.
Is that hurting Amazon? Well, I mean,
the people who really were pushing for this were like Microsoft, for instance, other American search companies as well. You know, they had Bing.
Right, but we're not talking about search. We're talking about comparison shopping.
But they also, comparison shopping was a huge part of Bing's business plan.
And Bing wanted Google to link to Bing more prominently?
I don't know exactly what their demands were. But to give you, I guess, a little bit of background about where this whole saga started, American companies like Microsoft were pressing the American FTC to bring a similar action. And actually, there's a lot of controversy about what happened there. Because in the end, the Federal Trade Commission decided no, they were not going to sue Google over the same thing that Europe is now cracking down on them. However, it later came out that their own staff researchers had put out a report saying, yes, you should bring a case over this same behavior. So there were definitely people at the FTC who thought Google was acting anti-competitively over these same issues. The kind of political appointees at the FTC decided, nope, we're going to vote against. And so it went over to Europe, which is now acting as sort of the world's antitrust enforcer.
One of the key questions I have here in my mind is whether there's some kind of regulatory interest in keeping search as a pure, like, search of the rest of the internet and stopping it from becoming a one-stop shop.
Yeah.
So what Google has increasingly done is if you Google a person, it will give you information about that person right there on the search result page. If you Google a business, it will give you the phone number, the address, the map, like the stuff you need. If you Google for a certain product, they will link you, you know, they will give you that product straight there. And that is, they're not like searching, well, they are kind of searching the web for that, but they are also providing this as a service. They're saying, like, you shouldn't need to make a second click if you don't want to. And that's not search, really, but I feel like that's clearly good for consumers.
Right. And I also think when you're talking about Google's competitors, it is important to remember that I think when people think, oh, well, who's competing against them in search? And they think like Bing. But I would disagree with that. It also has to do with how people access the internet. And it's the idea of as things become increasingly mobile and people increasingly use apps, if you're going to buy something on your phone, you're just going to go to the Amazon app. You're not going to go through Google. So there's a question as people shift more and more towards mobile. How is that going to impact the revenues of Google? So they're going to then have to change their business plan somewhat. Again, I'm not saying there's no justification for some of this lawsuit, but I do think this idea that Google has no competitors is not entirely accurate.
No, and I don't think anyone's saying that. But the deep question here is really like, what is Google going to do? I think like the European Union has said, well, the remedy here, quite aside from the $2.4 billion fine, is you can promote your own Google Shopping service only insofar as you do so on an even playing field with any other comparison shopping services. And for me, like, the only way they can possibly do that is by just getting rid of those Google Shopping results altogether.
Yeah, and how does that interact with things like Maps? I mean, like, you know, other services that Google adds that
Maps
are
Maps is the obvious next step here, that if you can't promote Google Shopping, then you can't promote Google Maps either.
Yeah, I think there is definitely, but I mean, this whole subject of bundling is, I feel a little bad because I went on this whole rant about antitrust last week, and bundling is this one area where actually I do feel a little bit ambivalent because it's really hard to figure out where to draw the lines. It's not simple, like we're talking here.
Right.
It's like, what is the next step? And, you know, I was looking at this and feeling ambivalent, but, you know, there are other instances of bundling that have much more profound economic consequences. One example that's been written about in law reviews is things like app stores, where Apple makes everyone come through its app store to buy, you know, Spotify or any third-party app. And that actually puts its own apps at an advantage, essentially, over its competitors.
Because Apple, it doesn't need to pay a cut to Apple.
Exactly.
Right?
Spotify has to pay a cut to Apple because it uses the app store. Apple Music does not have to pay a cut to Apple. So, I mean, there are things like that. I'm wondering, well, are we going to see the entire, you know, if they come after bundling, are we going to see the entire mobile economy like subject like
but that would be
tossed around
good,
by
right
maybe.
I mean I wouldn't have a problem with people forcing Apple to tighten to loosen some of the control that it has over the app store. I mean, I've, you know, app developers for years have been asking for things like paid upgrades, which they haven't been able to get.
Absolutely. I think it could be good. But I'm just saying that's one huge example. Once you start, if Europe is going to start cracking down on various forms of bundling in the internet and mobile economy, it's a really big deal. And I think given how aggressive they've been or how aggressive they seem to want to be, like, we're going to see. This is just the beginning, I think. I really believe that.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay. So, Anna, it was not that long ago that we were extolling the virtues of Europe's bank resolution regime and how wonderfully it worked in Spain.
We may have to amend that slightly.
So it turns out that when it comes to what are popularly known as the pigs, Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, that they are not all the same when it comes to resolving their banks.
No.
And Italy had two banks in the Veneto. That's the sort of rich region in the northeast.
Around Venice, yes.
Which were troubled. Yes. And the European banking authorities determined that they were insolvent or basically not capable of continuing, just as they did with the Spanish bank a few weeks ago.
Correct.
Except the result was a bit different.
Yes. So if you remember, with the Spanish bank, there was basically no state aid involved. So what happened here is because the European body said it is not in the public interest for this bank to be resolved through your EU law, they then said we will allow it to be essentially resolved through Italian insolvency procedures.
So wait, which is the Italians said that or the Europeans said that?
So the Europeans said that it was not in the public interest for it to be done through EU, and then they acquiesced to allowing it to be resolved through the Italian banks.
The Europeans were perfectly happy with the Spanish bank to be resolved through EU law. Why were they not happy with the Italian banks being resolved in the same
they
way?
They said that it... This is where it's actually quite a contradiction, because they said it essentially... These banks weren't systemic.
They're tiny.
Right, which is true. It only represented like 2% of the Italian banking system. But the reason that that is a contradiction is because then the reason that the Italian government used for why they had to essentially bail out creditors was because it was systemic.
So okay,
systemic to Italy.
So this is what I don't understand at all, because I had this sort of pocket model in my head of what was going on, which was that the Italian government, for various reasons, is more prone to bailing out its banks than the Spanish government is. And so when an Italian bank fails, there are various kind of hidden levers of power where the banks, and specifically the bank creditors, the people who are owed money by the bank and who might well get wiped out in a Spanish-style restructuring, those people manage to sort of twist the Italian government's arm and persuade the Italian government to throw in a few billion euros to bail them out. What you're saying is that actually it wasn't like political pressure from the creditors which did this, but it was actually pressure from outside Italy entirely. It was the EU saying don't do this.
Not necessarily. So what I'm saying is the EU didn't stop the Italian government from doing this. Essentially, they allowed a loophole to exist so that instead of having to abide by the rules of the BRRD, the Banking Recovery and Resolution Directive, which would have required 8% of liabilities to be bailed in before any state aid could be injected, they instead just said, okay, we're not going to resolve this through EU law. And then when the Italians said, okay, well, then we're going to take care of this through Italian law, they just let them.
So the question is, the first question I have is, why did the Italian government want to spend 15 billion euros or whatever it was bailing out these tiny banks when they had a perfectly workable way of resolving these banks without spending a penny?
Because many of the senior unsecured bondholders are mom and pop investors. That is essentially the biggest reason why this happened. And it's also, frankly, because the banking industry is very closely tied to the PD, the governing party. And this is where this also gets a little dicey in terms of how this bailout of creditors occurred, because essentially what happened is there was taxpayer money, this state money, that was injected to this other bank that took over one of the most well-capitalized banks in Italy that only took over the good assets. All the bad assets are being put in a bad bank. And they still were given all of this state aid to essentially shore up their balance sheet. They were given $1.3 billion to pay for firing people.
It's almost as though the Italian banking system is deeply enmeshed with the Italian government and the whole thing is quite corrupt.
Yes, which is part of how this whole problem existed in the first place. Because part of the reason that all of these retail investors are holding this paper that was significantly risky was because they were told it wasn't risky. They were told, like, no, you know, like... They did not explain the difference between senior secured and senior unsecured. And so that's why essentially we are in the situation we're in.
Well, I mean, the Italian investors as well are historically bond investors in the way that Americans aren't. But I think what you really put your finger on something important here, which is that banks all have capital stacks. They have, you know, secured debt and unsecured debt and subordinated debt and equity and all of this kind of stuff. And in principle, you just sort of work through the capital stack until you get to a point where, mm-hmm. you know, you've managed to write off enough money to make the bank sensible again. In practice, that works exactly up until the point at which you reach mom-and-pop retail investors.
Right.
And when you reach mom-and-pop retail investors, whether they're depositors or whether they're bondholders or whatever it is, then politics starts happening.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question. Are Italian banks still selling mom-and-pop investors these savings instruments that are basically senior secured debt that they think are just like
unsecured.
Vanilla? Senior unsecured debt.
Yeah, there's been a big pullback on that.
Okay. Because it seems like the fact that Italian banks sold all, you know, Vincenzo and Maria, all these, you know, these savings vehicles are why it now can't really... I mean, it still has to do bailouts. It can't do what Europe is supposed to
be. Yeah, it's politically untenable. And I think there's also a question of, you know, why the EU allowed this to happen. And I think there's also, you could argue that we're kind of turning a corner in Eurozone. Like, the economy is looking pretty good. We have Macron. Well, in comparison, you have Macron and Merkel kind of, you know,
they're getting their groove. Europe's getting its groove back.
And
they went on vacation to Jamaica,
exactly.
And it's just feeling good about itself.
So I think there's a question of, like, they didn't really want to rock the boat. But the reason this is really significant, it's not just because we're talking about the Italian banking sector. It's because the whole point of the BRRD was that it's supposed to have teeth. It's supposed to be, you can't have a banking union if you don't have laws that affect everyone equally.
And why do we want a banking union? Because we have a single currency. And what happens in a single currency zone is that money will naturally flow to the safest banks, basically. That you're going to have this giant sucking sound where people move their money out of risky banks in Spain and Italy and Portugal and Greece and move them to safe banks in Holland and Germany. And if you have a banking union, then that helps reassure people in the southern countries that it's all one union.
Right. And it's also important to remember that the grand bargain we had was, okay, we'll go through with QE, which is essentially going to be supporting the bonds of all of these countries. But as part of that, you have to start severing the ties between the banking sector and the state. Otherwise, you have all these contingent liabilities.
Yeah.
Because sovereign debt crises and sovereign banking crises are, to a first approximation, indistinguishable.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you really want to get the banks sort of separated from the sovereign finances so that the sovereign finances can start getting a handle on those.
But Europe seemed comfortable making an exception here, or at least turning a blind eye to what Italy's doing.
Yes,
so it's undermining its
own. Entirely, because now we're essentially, if they can then, in the future, other countries now can say, okay, it's also not in the public interest for this to be resolved through EU. So we're going to take care of it through our own laws and then do exactly the same thing. So then all of a sudden you're going to have banks issuing riskier paper again because there's like, well, we have a state backing. Like, this is why you need firm laws that are applied the same everywhere.
My feeling is that this kind of parade of horribles is maybe a little bit overstated. That you have a clear example in Italy of a government which seems to be incredibly willing to bail out its banks at the drop of a pin. It's not obvious to me that any other European country is really in that situation.
Right, but you think if something happened with Deutsche Bank that they're going to let, you know, senior unsecured bondholders be bailed in?
But sure, because the Deutsche Bank bondholders are all, I don't know, sovereign wealth funds from
also, there's no way
Middle
that
East.
The European regulators are not going to sit back and say, oh, Deutsche Bank Germany, you take care of that. Like, they're gonna, like, that is the most systemically important bank in the world. They're
for
going
the most
to, they're
part,
gonna intervene.
Yeah, we think so. But again, this is why it's important to have universal laws. Otherwise, you just don't know. And I think, injects more risk into the system.
I I can see that argument, but I have this feeling that if it kind of injects a little bit of safety and backstop, that we have a system which can resolve banks fine, as we saw in Spain, And then we have another system which can also resolve banks, as we saw in Italy. And it's like having the sort of belt and suspenders approach. I mean, I can see the moral hazard argument about how like it injects risk and stuff, but I think ultimately it doesn't really make things riskier.
But it's also, to a certain extent, Italy is dealing with this banking problem. But again, by taking these measures, it's not really dealing with the underlying problems.
Well, sure, but that's an orthogonal issue. That's
of course, but again, it's, I think this is the problem though, when you keep allowing different countries to essentially take these ad hoc measures, you're not dealing with any of the fundamental problems. And that, in my mind, makes it much more likely that down the line, you're going to continue to have additional crises. And how are you supposed to have further integration of the EU if you don't essentially have a banking union? And if every country can deal with their banks differently, you do not have a banking union.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Okay. This is going to be a pretty wonky episode. I have a weird feeling about this one because after geeking out about bank resolution in Europe and about antitrust in Europe, we're now going to geek out about the correlation between minimum wage and employment.
That's not the geeky part. No, we're going to get much wonkier than that, Felix. that's light wonk.
Yes.
that's the fuzzy handcuffs of wonk. We're going to get red room
okay,
style
so
here.
Let's talk about Seattle, because Seattle has one of the highest, or if not the highest, minimum wage in the country.
Well, a few people, I don't know where it stands right now. So a few years ago, you may remember, dear listeners, Seattle became the first major city to raise its minimum wage up to $15 an hour, or at least set its minimum wage to raise to $15 an hour over several years. And this got everyone very, very excited. Obviously, progressives were thrilled to have this sort of policy victory. And economists were excited because they were like, holy shit, someone is going to massively raise the minimum wage, whether this is a good idea or not. And we're going to get to see what comes of it. And then the city of Seattle actually did something very cool. It decided to fund a series of studies by the University of Washington to track the outcomes of this grand policy experiment, just to see, okay, what's going to happen to our economy now that we've decided to embark on this? And this week, one of the first major studies in that series came out, and it wasn't...
what the city of Seattle
wanted. It wasn't so positive. And I should say, I don't know how many people may remember this or not, but at the time, I was a little skeptical of the idea of doing this. I was nervous. Felix was more on board with it. So the study came out, and basically what it found in the end was that this higher minimum wage ended up costing the average low-wage employee $125 per month. They actually made $125 less per month. And
this is one of the fascinating things, is because it turns out that Washington is one of, I think, only four states where the data that the government gets is not only about how much employees are being paid, but also about how many hours they work.
Yes.
And so what this study found was that, hey, yeah, there's a whole bunch of people who did actually see their wages go up as a result of the higher minimum wage, but those people ended up working fewer hours, and the number of hours that they lost more than compensated for the amount that they were paid per hour.
Exactly. And so this is sort of the... what this paper is showing is sort of the worst case scenario for what a minimum wage can do. Like almost every economist agrees a minimum wage can basically do one of three things. Either it's too low to matter, right? Your minimum wage is like, you know, just not going to be binding. It's not going to affect what businesses do because everyone makes more than it anyway. The second thing is you can raise it high enough that, you know, people get paid more as a result. Maybe some people lose their jobs, maybe none lose their jobs, but in the end, people are making more money overall. And then the third, the worst case scenario, is that you raise it so high that it cripples businesses, or businesses close, they cut back on their employees' hours because they can't afford them, and then you end up with what this paper says happened in Seattle, where they make less. So theoretically, for people who are skeptics of this, this paper should be sort of a spike the ball moment, like, ha ha, yes, we were right.
Right.
But
the economic models do work.
Yeah, but it's a really super interesting paper because of the data that they use, like you were saying, Felix. It's so unusual, but there are just a whole bunch of methodological things about it that people are a little uncertain of right now. And frankly, quirks in their findings that make even I'm kind of questioning. I don't really understand how it makes sense. And I can get into that deeper if you want.
We don't need to get too into the weeds about whether they're including like chain store,
right?
No. But
comparisons they're using.
Here's an example of the sort of thing that's popped up in this paper that critics are seizing on, and frankly, I've talked to the authors of the paper, and they haven't given an answer yet. They're saying we're going to address that eventually. This paper says outright at the beginning that the higher minimum wage in Seattle, which only has risen up to about $13 at this point, or at the point they're studying, should not affect the number of jobs at $19 an hour. It should not affect the number of people making more than $19 an hour or the hours they're working. That's just too high up the wage scale to be affected by this change. But then if you look at their tables of what happened to the restaurant industry, it implies that, in fact, the higher minimum wage increased the number of jobs above $19 an hour.
Increased
the number of jobs or hours of people working above $19 an hour. So that is kind of internally contradicting in the paper. It doesn't make any sense. And some critics are essentially saying, what we think you're actually picking up on is just Seattle's economic boom. What they're doing in this paper is comparing Seattle to a control group that is, they call a synthetic Seattle, where essentially they take a bunch, and frankly, I think financial economists would find this process really interesting, but we can talk about it another day. Anyway, they take a bunch of different parts of Washington state, and then they kind of weight them to try and recreate an economically equivalent of Seattle, or an agglomeration that is equivalent to the city of
Seattle.
Seattle
Frankenstein?
Yes, a Seattle Frankenstein up until the minimum wage change. So then you can compare the synthetic Seattle to what happened in the real city. And what people are saying is, well, maybe your control didn't really work. And so what you're just finding is that Seattle had a tech boom driven by Amazon, and this synthetic Seattle did not. And so this is the kind of thing where it's not really... it's not really a left or right thing right now. It seems like a lot of economists just in general who are interested in methods and, good social science are just trying to make sense of this and are a little hesitant to put too much stock in it yet. It's a really interesting first stab, and it's going to get better. It's a working paper, I think.
So, right. But just from a public policy perspective, let's take a whopping great big hypothetical and say that the findings of the paper are true.
Yeah.
And that, people did wind up working less and making less money. Would that be an argument that it was a bad idea and they shouldn't have done it? Or is that I can easily see an argument saying, look, a minimum wage is a good thing even if it causes these effects.
Well, I mean, this is
right, but if ultimately the workers that in theory you raise the minimum wage for are now making less, then the question is that benefiting them?
And there's a moral argument some people on the left will make that labor should be valued at a certain level, that a living wage is not just an economic thing, it's a symbol about what the value we place on work, and thus you should be able to support yourself on the minimum wage. The thing is, I'm sympathetic to that, but in the end, like Anna's saying, is if people, low wage workers, are coming out making less money as a result of this,
but also
that's really bad.
Having more time.
Well,
where they're not working.
Yeah, but I don't know how many.
I feel like if you have money and you have time, it's great.
Yeah.
If you don't, not as great.
Yeah, exactly. It's I would say if these findings hold, I would be really, really nervous about this. And like maybe it's a borderline idea in Seattle, but then you really have to question the idea of bringing a $15 minimum wage national at that point.
And as you say, like Seattle is a rich city, which we assume maybe, probably, perhaps might be able to afford this. We have definitely seen, I mean, the classic example is Puerto Rico, where you have the federal minimum wage in effect and is clearly too high and is causing massive disemployment effects in Puerto Rico. And there is a strong sort of bipartisan consensus that the minimum wage should come down in Puerto Rico.
So it's interesting you bring up Puerto Rico because, you know, there's actually been pushback from economists on the left about that. They've actually tried to say, oh, it's not, you know, the minimum wage's fault that Puerto Rico has all these problems. And I know, exactly. And I tend to agree, you know, Felix, I tend to agree with you on this about Puerto Rico. But the sad conclusion I've kind of just come to is that this policy argument is just not, or I mean, and this is how most policy arguments go, but it's just not going to be resolved by economic studies.
No one's
ever going to make a decision on this in the end based on the results of what this team in Washington finds. It's going to be fascinating and it's going to be great to write about, but it's just, that's not how the political debate is ever going to work.
Right. I think because what you're seeing is if you're on the right or on the left, you kind of pick the parts of the different studies that justify your conclusions. And I think that's...
Yeah, I'm not seeing a lot of people sort of changing their priors as a result of this study.
I'm one of the closest. But Jordan's getting there. I'm one of the, in the sense that like I was skeptical. I'm looking at this study that verifies or like that confirms all of my skepticism, except I'm skeptical of this new study. So,
right.
I'm trying to be a good Bayesian here.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Okay, let's have a numbers round. After all of this wonkery, I'm just going to lead off with a $700 number, which is totally unwonky. And it comes from a piece which Ita published about the Beatrice Inn.
Oh my God, that piece was unbearable. I mean, like, I know it was a great piece, but oh, the Beatrice Inn.
Ryan Sutton, the main restaurant critic for Ita, went to the Beatrice Inn and they have a legendary steak there. They dry age it, but they don't just dry age it. As they're dry aging it, they cover it in a cloth and the cloth...
Soaked in whiskey.
They soak it in whiskey. Now... You know, this is a fun gimmick, and I wouldn't mind trying this steak. But what Ryan did before ordering the steak was say, so how much does it cost? And the guy goes, it's $14 an ounce. And Ryan sort of blinks, and he goes, okay. And then the guy goes, and there's a minimum of 50 ounces. Which, if you do the math, works out at an absolute minimum of $700 for the steak. And then by the time you add on a tax and tip, this is a $900 steak.
I mean, this is the Beatrice Inn. It's owned by Graydon Carter, right? Like,
No, not anymore.
Oh, not anymore. It used to be.
But it's we often hear about like crazy prices for tasting menus and stuff. It's rare that we hear about a crazy price, this kind of crazy price, just for a steak.
How much would a cow cost?
Oh, man. Okay. My turn?
Yeah, your turn.
Mine's a pretty simple number. It's $12 billion. It's how much Warren Buffett made on his investment in Bank of America a few years back.
So he puts in $5 billion for a bunch of warrants.
Yep.
And now he's converting them into stock.
$17
billion. $17 billion worth of stock.
And he made $12 billion on that trade.
There you go.
I mean, like...
Good trade.
He's active management is alive and well.
Like Warren Buffett is good at his job. Like
yes, he is.
There are very few certainties in this world, but Warren Buffett is very good at what he does. Say whatever else you will about that weird man.
He is good. True. I mean, there is a sense in which his trades are to a certain degree self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
That right. Just because Warren Buffett places a very public vote of confidence in an institution, that means that everyone else starts piling in. But even so, I would agree.
But you had to work to get to, you know, you have to work to become Beyonce. Like, you know, and it becomes self-fulfilling that our albums are going to do great when they hit. And like, that's Warren Buffett.
Yes.
He's Queen Bee.
The Beyonce of finance. So I feel like my number is slightly a cop-out, but not entirely. So my number is zero. And this is the number of banks that failed the stress test, either the qualitative or quantitative, which was zero.
So this is the first time that's ever happened.
Yes. Because often they would... Even if they passed the quantitative, there were still some qualitative measures, and then it was kind of embarrassing.
And so now they're all like, woo, happy days are here again.
Oh,
and
their shareholders are like, woo, happy days are here because they're going to get a nice payout.
They've announced, I believe, a record like $92 billion of share buybacks in one day.
Yes.
It's just like, you know, that gif from The Wolf of Wall Street where Leonardo DiCaprio is just throwing money off the boat? That's what's happening right
basically,
now.
Basically.
But this take the money.
But this is ultimately good news, not only for bank shareholders, but also for people who are worried about systemic risk in the banking sector, right? The Fed, by failing to pass the banks up until now, has shown that it is actually taking these tests pretty seriously. And by giving them a passing grade now, people, it has credibility.
Yeah, agreed. More than the BRRD.
Okay, on which note, I think we will wrap this episode of Slate Money up. We will talk to you next week, but I need to thank Dan Schrader, who produced this podcast. I need to tell you to go listen to I Have to Ask, which is Isaac Chodner's podcast where he interviews people. I need to tell you to email us on slatemoney@slate.com because that's how we get all of our ideas. And I need to tell you to stay subscribed, leave us reviews, and listen to us next week, where I'm pretty sure we're not going to be as wonky as this week, because it would be hard to be as wonky as this week. On Slate Money. Money don't make me happy, and a fella can't make me fancy. We're smiling for a whole nother reason. It's all smiles through all four seasons. Shining, 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 shining.